Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Yes, welcome back to Breaking Banks. I am Brett King, and today we are talking about mobile first investing, and some other stuff. First of all, our fellow Provoke media host, Ron Shevlin, is joining us again. Ron, welcome
back. How are you, Brett? To the show. Thanks.
Oh, well, I'm struggling today, but you already know that. I got this stomach flu thing, but thanks for asking. And Brian Romley is back on. He's our expert on voice first and payments in general. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Brett. Wonderful to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you back on. All right, before we get to our first guest, Brandon Krieg, who's the CEO and co-founder of Stash, we've got a few announcements and some news to get through on the conference side of things. Our fellow Provoke host, Jason Henricks, host of FinTech 5, he's going to be at the American Bankers Association National Conference for Community Bankers February 25 to 28 at Waikiki. And they're talking about leadership management questions facing community banks and their staff. And if you're headed to Austin for South by Southwest, then Provoke is the media partner for an exclusive FinTech Luminaries VIP reception. Just message at Jason Henricks on Twitter if you're interested in attending, and he will look after the rest. You can hear Jason speak at South By on Banking Disrupted on Tuesday, March 12th from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. Okay, so in the news, I don't know whether you guys have observed this, Ron and Brian, but have you observed the number of stories talking about the rate of disruption and the impact of disruption to banking is speeding up? And more, like, you know, for example, obviously Financial Brand, Jim's portal for this and others. There seems to be a lot more articles on the fact that fintechs are able to do innovation much cheaper and faster, and banks are underestimating the level of disruption. Is it just me, or are you guys noticed sort of an uptake in those types of headlines?
Well, Brett, I can tell you, I've definitely noticed it. And simultaneously, we're seeing more and more branches being closed down. I think, what is it, another 1,200 branches were announced this week that are going to close. So I think in that backdrop, it must be horrifying for bankers. And, Jim, with his Financial Brand, he's doing so well in surfacing all this. So I think it's a great time for fintechs and great time for innovation.
Definitely agree with Brian and you that there's definitely an uptick in the number of articles and press releases around these things. I think it has a lot to do with the general mood of what's going on. So I think it has a lot to do with the general mood in the industry right now. There's, despite some downturns, and negative signs, there's general optimism. I just surveyed about 250 mid-sized bank and credit union executives, and their level of optimism for the industry is at a five-year high. And it's not about the threat of disruption and the threat of fintechs. It's about the opportunities to partner with them and take advantage of the opportunities and technology that they're bringing to the table. So I don't think that they're looking at this as a negative. I think they're looking at it as a positive.
Wow, that's a big shift. When did that shift happen? Because over the last 2 years, I've been hearing, I'm afraid of these fintechs. So that's a relatively new shift, huh, Ron?
Well, this is the second year in a row that the optimism levels have ticked up in the survey I've done. And we've been doing this at Cornerstone for about 5 years now. They were definitely lows in about the 2010-2011 time frame before I started doing this, and was pretty negative even at 2012-2013. Yeah. But, a lot of folks aren't going to like this, Brian, but reality is that post the Trump election, optimism in the industry really started to tick up. Initially, it was about deregulation, and we didn't really see a lot of that in 2017. But now it's really reflecting more about the general economy and the prospects, although there are still some negative signs, especially around auto lending and even in commercial lending. The other thing I know that Brett had wanted to pop in on the news was I don't know if you saw this, and this is actually going to be something we'd love to get into discussion with Brandon when we get him on. Did you see the news that Overstock launched a robo-advisor tool and a financial platform?
Incredible. Yeah, you're going to see a lot more coming from that company. They seem to be innovating around everything they possibly can, from blockchain and everything. I feel strongly that we're going to see just about everybody jump into this robo-advisor type of scenario. Now, what that means is sort of a catchphrase, right? Because that can mean anything from, you know, crypto assets to traditional assets to even new hybrids. And I think we're going to start seeing a lot of those hybrids coming up very soon, where we're sort of mixing these things into IRAs and other types of retirement accounts as we move along. So it's a vital period of time.
So yeah. There are a couple of things that really interested me, and Brett, maybe you can jump in here. We're talking about Overstocks launching a robo-advisor and a general financial platform or marketplace. And one of the things that really struck me in the press release that Overstock sent out was the comment from their financial services guy that they were going to launch a robo-advisor, you know, using their own AI tools and technology and their own advice, which makes me think, where does a retailer get the capabilities, competencies, where do they get the competency and capabilities to offer financial advice? You know, could anybody get into the robo advice market at this point?
This is one of the challenges. I mean, if you it's all data based, right? And depending on what data they have, does that data inform investment strategy? I know in China, for example, that Alibaba's data that they've got on the platform now is starting to really concern banks like ICBC, who's increasingly getting less and less visibility because they're not involved at the transaction level. And so this has pushed ICBC, for example, to launch a competitive business portal, Rongi Gao, they call it, basically an e-commerce portal to compete with Alibaba. They've felt like they've had to get into the retail or the commerce business. It's more business commerce, but they've had to get into that because of the data that Alibaba has and how that's able to inform their decisions on products and so forth. But robo advisors generally are doing pretty well. I mean, if you look at the data from Barron's did a research on this from 2016 and 2017. And robo-advisor platforms are already starting to return sort of 11 to 12% annually on portfolios. And if I remember from my days training with wealth managers and private bankers and so forth, that was about the return you'd expect from a human advisor paired with an asset management team. So there's negligible difference in terms of return now.
Yeah. So what was there was I think there was something else you wanted to talk about, Brett, in the news.
I'm finding this obviously the traction around the fintech impact. But if you go to sites like Finextra or Financial Brand or something now, whereas a year ago or maybe 3 years ago, we'd have a lot more industry-based news. The majority of stories now are essentially technology and fintech. And so if that is a feel for or indication of the traffic the restructuring of the industry from a competencies perspective, it's something maybe it's a soft anecdotal type of stat, but certainly I'm seeing a lot more of that. I did see a couple of there's on the payment side of things. Did you guys see that Apple has partnered with Alipay in China to include Alipay payments in their stores?
I think that's incredible news. Alipay is moving very rapidly, across many platforms, and I think as we see Alipay come to America more aggressively, this is something that I think should be concerning other payment platforms, most definitely. I mean, it's definitely shunting payments away from the major Visa MasterCard brands.
What do you guys think Alipay is going to do now that the U.S. basically shut down their MoneyGram acquisition?
Probably blockchain at some point, either acquiring or building one on their own. I think there is a
try and acquire another financial services business, or do you think that that door is being shut to them?
Oh, I think it's shut to them. I think in this political climate, there's no opportunity for them to do something of that scale in the U.S. You know, there's a lot of very creative companies out there that are kind of leapfrog over what we were seeing at those locations anyway. I mean, you know, what is it? 10 years? We're probably not going to even need those physical locations to any high degree. And so what are they buying into?
It's yeah.
Interesting.
No, I think, but they were, it was pretty clear they were getting, they were simply, you know, buying a license.
No doubt.
Yeah. All right. Well, certainly on the robo-advisor investing stuff, I think it's all going to be about the behavioral stuff. More and more, we're starting to see, we're now starting to look at behavioral-based approaches to investment that I think are really differentiated. So I think that's where we're going to start to see people focus more on where can I get you from a behavioral perspective? What data can I get that helps me learn about your behavior? And you know, what data partnerships can I have that will give me access to that? You guys know, I was in Cairo at the start of the week, and I was there with Sopendu Sopendu Mahanti from the Monetary Authority in Singapore. And he made a really interesting point to me. I don't know if he's listening to the show, but he said to me that he thinks, from a regulatory perspective, the next big battleground is data residency, and that he fully expects that regulators like Singapore and London will go after making themselves safe data repositories for data outside of their jurisdiction, so that if you want to be a Indonesian or Vietnamese bank on the cloud and you want to make sure your data is secure, that Singapore will be able to host that data for you as a hub. So even regulators now are starting to think about data as a central piece of the puzzle. Pretty interesting, I thought.
Very interesting. How big of a market do you think that's going to grow into? I mean, do you think there's really aggressiveness in that from a country level?
I think if you think about Estonia, with their digital identity program and so forth, I think, you know, it's not going to be crazy to think of a few of these regulated markets that are pretty aggressive saying, we will handle KYC for anyone in the world. You know, and they'll build a blockchain-based identity program or something like that, and basically say you can come anywhere from anywhere in the world, and we'll do the KYC, and we'll become a central KYC repository for any bank that's in our jurisdiction to use that. So that now suddenly, this whole principle that you need to be a customer. You can only be a customer of a bank if you live in that physical location. I think that concept is going to disappear soon. I think, then it's all on, because you know any of these new regions essentially can own the KYC and allow you to, as a customer, to come into that data residency or that jurisdiction and open a bank account, regardless of where you live.
You know,
as long as you can provide enough identity data. Sorry. Yeah, Ron.
Do we have time for one other regulatory-related piece of news?
Sure.
The outgoing Fed chairman, and when I say outgoing, I don't mean personality-wise, I mean job. Janet Yellen last week, as a parting shot, took a whack at Wells for their wrongdoings.
Yeah.
And basically, the Fed has barred Wells from expanding its assets beyond their 2017 levels, which of course made Elizabeth Warren happy, just to throw one more W word in there. But the reason I wanted to bring that up was that this is not just about Wells. This has a huge message to a lot of U.S. banks, because what it really signals is that the board of directors now have to be a whole lot more involved and have a much greater level of awareness about the risk management practices, because they are potentially held responsible. This is not just a whack at Wells. This has huge impact on pretty much every bank in the U.S., and that's why I think this is a super important piece of news.
I don't think we've ever seen that sort of control put on bank in terms of asset growth.
Not in modern times at all. I mean, you had smaller banks maybe in the 30s and 40s, but nothing like this.
It's, well, here's unprecedented. Here's the funny thing, the ironic thing about this was that, you know, 2 years ago, Wells got in trouble for putting too much on the books, and now they're probably getting in trouble for not putting enough on the books. So I'm just joking, Wells, just joking.
All right, well, let's get to our main interview for the first half of the show. And at this point, we want to invite Brandon Krieg. He's the CEO of Stash. Stash is a very fast-growing investment savings app. They've already got 1.6 million customers. They've got 30,000 new customers joining every week. So, but it's not your average investment app. And, you know, we obviously this is a class of one of a class of new apps that are emerging in sort of in terms of behavioral investing now. Digit, Acorns, and so forth are part of this group. But there seems to be there are edge opportunities to design new experiences that stimulate investing. So, Brandon, first of all, tell us about Stash. Tell us how Stash got started, and tell us what Stash is.
Yeah, great. First of all, it's great to be here with you guys, and thanks a lot for having me. Stash really started because my co-founder Eddie and I both worked for a very large Australian bank named Macquarie Securities. And we were together building a global trading business, algorithmic trading business there. And we started thinking a lot about what does the future of investing look like for the 90% of America that's underserved, so not for the wealthy. Because everyone focuses on the rich, but how do you focus on everyone else? And then one magical day, someone who works in one of the groups there had come over to Eddie and me and said, "Hey, I have some extra money. Where should I invest it?" And we looked at ourselves and we went, "Well, hold on a second. Somebody that works in finance is asking us where to invest their money. I wonder what everyone else thinks." And so we decided that this was something we wanted to take on. So we ended up resigning from our jobs. And the first thing we did is we literally started walking around the streets of New York City and just going up to people in the street and saying, "Hey, you know, could you talk to me about investing and saving? Do you invest?" And it was amazing. Almost every single person answered the same way when we asked the question, which was, "No, I don't invest, but I really, really want to. I don't understand it. It's so confusing. It's so complicated." And then we also kept hearing, "I'll do this later when I'm rich." And we would say to people, yeah. Right, that's what we said. And we're like, "Well, could you tell me what rich is? What do you think rich is?" And nobody could answer the question. It was always, "I'll do it later. I'll do it later." And we're like, "All right, we know what we're going to do."
Ron, you know my thought on this, right, is that I think that this whole argument that you need financial literacy before you can have investment, you know, I've always said that I think tools can replace that need for financial literacy, and that you can build essentially financial education or financial literacy into a tool set. The fact that you have this as a precursor, you must be educated. You know, you must understand the time value of money and, you know, Sharpe's ratio and alpha and beta and all of that before you can effectively invest. I think that's garbage. I think part of this is the tools that we can create.
Yeah. Wall Street, you know, I started my career on Wall Street in 1998. You guys were using the word disruptive for. I was one of the first disruptors of the way that stocks were traded. I built helped build one of the first algorithmic trading systems on Wall Street in 1998. And you think about disruption now, you know, the way we think about, you know, the point of education is the way that people learn. If you look, you got to take your cues from finance to early childhood education. You know, think about how children learn engineering now versus how they learned it 20 years ago, right? 20 years ago, you'd read a book, probably forget pretty much everything you read and never do it. Nowadays, people learn by doing, right? So kids, like my kids, learn engineering by building circuits on, you know, new types of toys that are educational. And so it's the whole world of investing and education has changed. And we think that by leading with education, and I'll talk more in a second about kind of where we're going with Stash and what Stash is, but education is really, really important to getting people off the sidelines, which is probably one of the main reasons we've gotten now almost 1.8 million people off the sidelines to start investing and saving for their futures.
Hey, Brandon, it's Ron. How are you differentiating yourself from the Betterments and Wealth Fronts of the world?
Oh, I mean, there's so many things that differ us. I mean, the first thing is, we didn't want to build an AUM-dependent business because it puts too much pressure on our customers. The relationship that we want to have with our customers is going to be lifelong, but our customers represent and look like America. Our average customer is 29. The average household income of our customers is just a bit over $45,000 a year. And our customers, you know, drive for car services. They are in the military. They're nurses and teachers. They're not wealthy, but they're awesome and they live, you know, really good lives. They just want to learn about investing. So telling our customers that, you know, you can come to Stash and we'll help you with tax loss harvesting or, you know, complex index replication, things like that, that's going to make them just not do it. You know, our customers are coming to us because they want to get on the journey. They want to start saving and investing. And 86% of Stash customers are either first time or beginner investors.
Okay. So you start with as little as $5 for an investment. But if I went to a traditional investment house or wealth management firm, the first thing they'd get me to do is sit down and do a risk profile questionnaire so they could work out where I should be, you know, what sort of risk tolerance I'd have, where I'd be moderate risk or adventurous or not, and with, you know, what the spread of my investment should look like. Should it be focused on growth or should it be focused on income? How do you guys get started with just $5 and what's the process?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So the process of coming to Stash is you download the Stash app or you go to the web version of Stash and you start opening an account. And during the process, it takes about 2 minutes to start and finish. You answer some questions about, you know, the typical suitability questions. And through our back end, we come up with what we think your risk profile is to get you started. And once you start, people can start with $5. And the $5 number in there is really just to get people across the line to start. The average customer on Stash, though, is putting away about $23 a week using something we call AutoStash. Because just coming to Stash and putting $5 in once, and that's it, isn't really great for us, and it's definitely not good for you. But most of our customers turn on weekly AutoStash. And once you start investing in the recommended investment, we have something we call the Stash Coach. And the Stash Coach is a big part of your financial journey as you use our platform. And it's going to keep giving you tips and guidance to get diversified, to add more investments, to do more things to become a better investor. And we are an investment advisor, so we are giving recommendations to our customers. So think about Stash is that we've digitized this process that the wealthy get right now. To start, you know, if they walk into an investment advisor, they certainly have more than $5 to start, or that meeting would never take place. But we want to get people headed in the same path because we think whether you have, if you have $100 or $10 million, you still have the same aspirations for your future. You still want to retire well. You still want to live a good life. You still want to, you know, send your kids to college. And these are the things that Stash is doing really well for our customers.
So in terms of the portfolios you have managing for your customers, how is the platform performing in terms of returns?
Yeah, you know, we are not a short-term performance-oriented firm. Our focus is on long-term investing and getting our customers to put...
Are you trying to get people to stimulate to save using the investment as a savings mechanism?
Yeah, that, and we want people to dollar cost average, and we want people to learn those time-tested investment principles that we really believe in, which is to not time the market, to dollar cost average, and to invest for the long term. And so our customers, even though, you know, if you look, we've been, we launched October 15 of 2015. And so a lot of our customers now have been growing their accounts $5, $10, $20 a week, every week consistently for the last 2.5 years. So effectively, a lot of them are performing exactly how the market's performed. But customers on Stash get to invest with intent so they can choose what they're investing in, right? So right now we have about 43 different investment options and options, that a customer can choose. And then from there, the coach will help them diversify and add different investments to keep their portfolio well-rounded.
Hey, so Brandon, it's interesting you said that you've got a long-term focus. I was going to ask you, what were you telling Stash customers last Friday when the Dow was at 26,000?
You know, it's a good question. We told them the same thing we told them every single week since we launched, which is don't time the market. You're in this for the long term. You know, and what we saw Friday and earlier this week and even today is our customers are just continuing to dollar cost average and invest on a schedule every week because our customers aren't doing this for one day or one week. They're doing it for 10, 20 years, right? And so, you know, we believe that this is noise, you know, the same way that, you know, I dollar cost average through 9/11, through, you know, multiple recessions, through the Great Recession of 2008. And I'm going to keep doing it, and Stashers are as well. So we saw basically no real change this week, and we're really proud of our customers for that. They just kept investing right through it.
Brandon, tell me about the structure from a perspective of how you're structured. Are you a bank? Are you, you know, are you an advisory? You know, what's the architecture of the business, both from a regulatory perspective and from a technical perspective?
Yeah, sure. We are not a bank. We are a registered investment advisor and a FINRA member as a broker dealer. And those two entities run the investing service. We just became a broker dealer to be able to cut some fees for our customers. You know, we are definitely, we announced a banking service or a DDA service for our customers, but we are not becoming a bank, at least right now for the foreseeable future. It's just too time consuming and we don't know if we're going to get approved, so it's not worth the energy. But what we do focus on is, you know, helping customers in lots of parts of their lives. So we also just recently filed an insurance brokerage to be able to help our customers there. But SEC registration is important to us being an investment advisor because we want to be able to give financial advice to our customers.
So one of the things I'm interested in, and Brian is probably keen for me to ask this question as well. I'm surprised he didn't as so far. But
I was almost there.
Yeah. Is what role is voice going to play in the future of investment? Because the advice component is, you know, asking your Alexa unit or your Google Home, whatever in the future, say, you know, how best can I invest this money I've got? Just like that friend came up to you in the office and asked, where should I be putting the money? That's the sort of thing we're going to see people using Alexa for. What do you guys think about the role of voice in investing?
We are an engineering company. We're taking on a lot of really complex engineering projects right now. Our commitment to our customers is to be there with them through everything. But you know, we want to keep our costs really low. We are not pivoting to opening up, you know, a lot of the big robo advisors. We're not a robo advisor, but some of the robos opened human advice, right? We can call an advisor. That's not the role that we're going to play. We do believe, and we are making investments into AI and, you know, kind of computer controlled interactions where you can speak to Stash. And we have a lot of really awesome surprises in the future. But I do agree that that is the future of investing. And it's a hole right now that not a lot of people are filling.
And just probably the last question we've got time for, how are you guys going about acquiring customers? Because 1.6 million individual customers is pretty impressive.
Yeah, and then the fact that we did it in less than 2 years makes it makes it even more cool. And I think, you know, we have a really big focus on financial education. And so that helps us a lot because, you know, we're empowering our customers to do this thing that they always thought was so scary. And so what we're finding now is that a lot of our growth is coming from word of mouth, you know, friends telling friends about the fact that they started investing or the fact that we made investing super relatable. So as we continue to scale, we're seeing that a lot of it's now just coming from word of mouth and referrals.
Great. So if you want to find out more about Stash, you can go to stash.com. And what other channels would you recommend people follow, Brandon?
I would tell
people that. Do you have a Twitter feed?
Go to learn. learn.stashinvest.com. Learn.stashinvest.com is a great place to go and start getting some financial education to understand how we think about the markets and money.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thank you. It was great, and I really appreciate it.
No problem. All right, so guys, we're going to have a quick break, and after the break, we'll be back with another friend of the show, Travis Delaney, CEO of Push Payments, and we'll have more for you guys right after these short messages from our sponsor.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
And we are back from the break. It's Ron Shevlin here, which you knew because I'm the guy that does not have the cool Australian accent. We've got Travis Delaney, CEO of Push Payments. We've got a frequent guest of the show, Travis Delaney, CEO of Push Payments. In fact, last time I was co-hosting a couple months back, Travis, you were on. We had a pretty good discussion around faster payments, and I hope we get into some of that as well. Welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Thank you, Ron. It was great to be back. Good to talk to you again, Brett.
So during the break, we were chatting briefly, and I know you wanted to bring up some recent news. What was on your mind?
Well, you know, I guess it's a number of things, but nothing really I'd say is new, but more of just of understanding as this area of faster or otherwise real-time payments is evolving. You know, an article was just out today in the Financial Brand that culture of impatience impacting, consumer expectations. And it clearly says, it starts out, speed is no longer a luxury. It's not a nice to have, but a need to have. And it's just really about how things are changing, right? So we recently...
Yeah, who's going to wait 3 days for a check to come, you know?
Those days are over.
Yeah, but it isn't about the check. It's about having access to the money. But, you know, Travis, we look across the globe, and there's no question that real-time payments has become practically a part of life in Asia, but yet the U.S. definitely not. Is that changing in the U.S., and if so, why?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a necessity. I mean, last year, 2017, I think, was deemed as the year of faster payments, and 2018 is more of the year of the first adopters and the really change where it gets out to the public and to the consumers and corporates alike so that they understand how it makes a difference, right? So I think the next couple of years will be key in that adoption and realization from the marketplace.
Here's something I want to run by you. The ICBA, the Community Bank Association, Independent Community Bank Association, did a poll of its members. And honestly, I don't know the exact date of this poll, but I don't think it's too long ago. And they asked their members, is 2020 a realistic time frame to establish a ubiquitous faster payments governance framework in the U.S.? And obviously, it's not necessarily a scientific poll here, but here's the results. 16% said yes, 14% said no, leaving 70% to say unsure because the Fed needs to play an operational role in faster payments. And do you see the Fed doing that and being able to do it?
That question almost sounds right out of some of the mouths of the faster payment members, actually. In the community market space, especially, ICBA obviously supports the community banking arena, and it does take government involvement. And the key word you said is the government piece of that. So, you know, today there's different providers like ourselves that are have found ways to get to the market earlier without the government support. But at the same time, the government support overall for ubiquitous coverage, it's going to be needed. It is very ambitious, but they're also very focused on providing that type of service. There's a lot of work to do. Now, being part of the task force gave me a first-line insight to some of the challenges that I don't know that I had appreciated earlier. And I saw some of the challenges of just like community bank, you know, what their needs and wants are from a banking perspective, what the large banks and the regional, they all have different needs. They're different types of corporations, really, but they just have different needs. So,
well, challenges, you know, like what specifically were you talking about in terms of challenges, and how do those challenges differ between, say, the big mega banks and community banks and work credit unions in there as well?
Right. No, actually, very excellent question, because we have to first understand who they are. You have to understand the psyche of a community bank versus a regional versus a large, and credit unions too, right? So they have different needs or interests or people they serve, right? For example, credit unions, right? They are member organizations that serve large corporations typically, right? And so it is tied to, you know, one or a few corporates that then their members are their customers. So it's really intertwined. So one of the perfect examples is, you know, a recent announcement we made with one of many gig economy players, Zazen. And it allows, to get that payroll advance, right? So not advance, that's the wrong word for it, but it's a pull on current end income. So, you know, you got somebody that gets paid every 2 weeks, and then the Friday before, you know, they have a pet that gets sick and has to go to the vet. They need cash. They need it now. So how do they get it? So this is a mechanism that allows not only banks but also employers to provide that to their employees to, you know, get their paycheck a little early for what they've already earned. So we facilitate that in a real-time fashion. It's almost an emergency mechanism, right? So credit unions is perfect for that. But now when you talk about community banks and larger banks, you know, community bank is, I category them as almost like a small business, because they know the people in the town. They know, a lot of times they've know their kids, they've mortgaged their home, they've put their kids to college. It is extremely different than the relationships held with their customers at the regional and the large level. Large levels about volume and commercializing and repeatability, you know, of their processes. It's truly commercialized. And then the regionals are normally got very niche markets, whether it be an MSB type of bank or, you know, a larger regional consumer type bank. So, you know, if you look at them, they have niche markets. So they all have different needs. So if you think about that first, now you've got a community bank that's got, what, 8 employees, 25 employees, and a very small level, they don't have IT people. they don't understand all that aspect. They have to go to a service provider, or they might have a desktop support person, and that's it. They're not savvy in the way of that. They're savvy in the way what makes their community tick. And so that's a personal relationship. It's a different approach. And Ron, you know this because you talk a lot about AI and you talk a lot about the automation and the mobile banking and how that's pulling that away. So you know the pressures on those smaller banks. So it only gets worse, right? And that's everything from liquidity and asset and debt ratios. It makes it a lot harder for those smaller ones. So that's just a beginning.
So Travis, my question to you is this, is that, obviously in China, you've had an explosion in mobile payments, in the last 3 years. China did $5.5 trillion in mobile payments. That means they did about 90% of mobile payments globally, and 90% of that was done over two technology networks, Alipay and WeChat. So this is a pretty fundamental change in the way we think about payments. And obviously now you've got mobile commerce shifting to voice and things like that. Why is it that there's hesitancy or resistance to that overall trend in the US, because it just is moving so slowly compared with other markets like China?
It's really simple. And I've actually said this, I think, on your show before, and I've used the term, our own maturity is our biggest Achilles heel, because it creates this legacy of financial systems and regulatory framework. So we've matured as an economy, and for so long we have been the economy that everybody, admired. But now it's just the opposite. So you've got, you can go back to India, you can go to, to Africa, and you've got all these other areas that have actually pole vaulted in the mobile banking arena, the mobile wallets, the instant movement of funds, because there was nothing there before. It's a lot easier to build Las Vegas in the middle of a desert when there's nothing there to build. So it's a lot harder to put a Las Vegas in the middle of New York City. And so that is really what it amounts to.
Travis, what I find really interesting is on the consumer side and person-to-person payments, and this is Brian over here, I was wondering, how do you see that accelerating awareness? I mean, we have Zelle coming out this week purporting a rather tremendous volume through their system. Has this aided you in getting more awareness, or is it just one more thing knocking over the camel's back here?
Yeah, absolutely it has, actually. I remember a story once when I was on one of the buses back from the airport to the Faster Payment Task Force, and one of the Federal Reserve guys had realized that we had been in the market and we had been there for some time, and he made a comment. He said, "You must be really annoyed that we're all coming out and doing this and everybody's getting together to do it, and you're first to market." And I actually turned around and said, "Not at all, because I am so glad that people can understand and have an appreciation of what it is and help with the idea of understanding what it does for people." So, we can sit here and talk about all these things, and you guys, and Brett especially with his global touring that he does, he has this viewpoint and this optic of these other countries that, here in America, we don't really know what happens. If it wasn't for things like Alibaba, we'd never know it kind of happens. We tend to be kind of myopic in what goes on here.
So that's not an excuse, Travis.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that's not an excuse.
Oh, no, I'm not giving an excuse. I'm just kind of stating kind of how it's evolved. Actually, Zelle, it brings awareness, because what it really is I go down to one basic principle. In the world of payments, there's only one thing that makes something work or not work, and it's called adoption. If you can't have people that understand the benefit or they don't adopt any type of idea that you have or don't have or in the market, then nothing matters. Now, that's at a basic psychological level. So what Zelle does and what Venmo does and all these P2P is it allows us to go, oh, I know how that works. It works like this. So then that bleeds over in the corporate world. You know, as you move into corporate and banking, people are a lot more conservative. There's more to lose. It's about bigger dollars and money. So you want vendors that you can count on and trust. So you got to make sure that their systems are working right. And so those are things that are impediments for purchasing and acquiring any product. So that to me, at least from my viewpoint, this has a lot to do with education and an appreciation. I spent 3 years at least talking about real-time payments, and people would look at me like I was nuts. It was impossible. I had some very high-level people and very name-brand organizations, I won't name on a show, that told me I was crazy. That would never exist. So, that to me, it actually has helped. So, you know, you're bringing that to attention is very important, because then it helps people realize it. You know, we study it. We see all the cases and the benefits. But sometimes you can tell somebody something and they just don't get it until they're ready to understand it.
You think that point is now, that it's becoming much more in the forefront, along with obviously the buzzwords of blockchain and cryptocurrencies and things of that nature with real-time payments?
No, absolutely. And actually, I attribute a lot of awareness in the payments world and the disruption that we're willing to change. Because this is an age-old industry that if it's not broke, don't fix it. And so that's been the mantra for years. I mean, if you go back just a couple years ago, there's only the big boys. FinTech wasn't a cool, sexy word. No. It was reserved for the FinTech 100 and the FISs and the TSIS and the First Datas, and that's it. So what I attribute most of this appreciation is Bitcoin. Because Bitcoin came out, not recently, because it's got kind of crazy lately, but that's the same behavior. You never had people investing in cryptocurrency, taking their hard-earned money and go and actually using it as an investment and buying stuff on speculation, basically. And that's happened in the last year. But Bitcoin allowed people to go, huh, that's a different way of doing it. And it sticks around. And the blockchain coming out of that, oh, we could do that. Well, that's interesting. You know, a blockchain could be argued, well, it's no different than using Java or something. It's just a approach, right, of a language or a way you do things. But in the end, absolutely. That the cryptocurrency space, and all disclosure, I bought Bitcoin at $12 because I was curious, not because I was smart, not that I knew the future. I was curious. How's that work? I'm a payments guy. I should figure this out. And so I did. And then I went away and forgot how much I had in there.
I hope you still have your password.
Yeah, well, I had to dig them up about a year or two ago, yeah.
Clearly you didn't buy enough of it or you wouldn't be on the show.
Pardon?
I said clearly you didn't buy enough of it or you wouldn't be here on the show with us today.
Yeah, well, no, that's for sure. Well, Amy, I don't even pay attention. I happened to the market jump. I realized it was at 20 thousand or something. I was like, holy moly, I didn't even know that. I just found it out after it hit like $7,000. But that's also the type of investor that, you know, this stash guy is talking about dollar cost averaging. That's the way you're supposed to invest, right? I in the old day, I used to be an investor. I was a licensed broker, and that's what we taught. Because it's not about speculation. It's not the short-term game. It's the long-term run. So, you know, I'm in the payments industry for the long run. I love this stuff. Been in it all my life. And then the same thing goes for anything like that. So that's why I look at these bigger trends, right? Not the flash of what happens today. Because the longer trends is what sticks around for the long term.
So, Travis, we've talked a lot about the retail side of the coin. What about the commercial side, the business-to-business payments? How is faster payments impacting that? Do you see that as having more impact or less impact, and who the winners and losers are going to be?
Oh, there's absolutely huge impacts. You know, aside from, you know, building new business models you've never thought about, like the Zazooms and the PayActives I've kind of mentioned, the payroll type of solution, the other impacts are simple. Some of them are just real simple. You know, the insurance disbursement models. Why spend out checks? You know, why not be able to disperse an insurance claim instantly after adjudication and actually send the explanation of benefits with the payment? That, you know, 2022 supports that, and we've been doing that for years through a product we call PayDoc. There's a lot of commercialization for liquidity. Instant merchant funding is one of the hottest products that we have that basically shortcuts the ACH process and allows it to settle in 1 second. So what that means is, here you've got a merchant. Let's say you got a restaurant, and they have a big Friday night dinner. Everything's going wonderful, but it's a long weekend, right? So that means the holiday on Monday, and so you come in on Friday. They do $500 worth of a dinner. When do you think they get that $500? And because most people have paid by credit card, so or debit or whatever, but when do you think they actually get the cash? Any guess?
Well, I know I can answer that. It's probably Monday to Tuesday morning because of the way the merchant system works.
Well, if the Monday is a holiday, they don't. It'll be Tuesday.
Oh, no, yeah. Tuesday,
right?
Yeah.
Right?
So if that happened on a Friday, it's all Friday to Tuesday.
Exactly. So you've got 5, maybe even 6 days before they get their cash. They still got Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So how much money are they floating just because people don't open up and allow them to get their money? They're floating, you know, $200,000 maybe, a couple million dollars, depending on how big of a restaurant or big of a bar. That's a lot of money. That's called liquidity. If we want our growth in our small business sector and we want growth in our economy, we need cash flow. Cash flow stems growth. And so that allows for that to facilitate very quickly and easily.
I have to agree because, I mean, I've been in merchant payments for 3 decades, and one of the biggest quagmires for Visa, MasterCard is they cannot fund, well, I mean, that's not Visa, MasterCard, it's just generally merchant accounts, can't fund over the weekends. And it's just, it's perplexing to merchants because they come back and say, what? Banks are closed, but why can't my money flow? And a lot of it has to do with the banking system, you know, and we're talking about hundreds and trillions of dollars that are tied up in this over the years. It's tremendous.
Well, listen, Travis, thank you for joining us on the show today. We're running out of time, my friend.
No problem. Thanks for having me again.
So, how can people find out about what you're doing lately these days?
Well, it's real simple. We push payments, right? So go to www.pushpayments.com, and we will move your money instantaneously under a second.
Very cool. And Ron, thanks for co-hosting and looking after things with me today.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Ann.
Where can we track down your latest musings, Ron?
A bunch of different places. The Snarketing column on thefinancialbrand.com. And if you guys do a search for Cornerstone Advisors Insight Vault, you'll find a lot of my daily musings.
Yeah, you just put a new report out, right?
I got a bunch of new reports out. Yeah, reinventing checking accounts is the one you want to check out.
Cool.
No pun intended.
And Brian?
You can find me with my first and last name, Brian, R-O-E-M-M-E-L-E, on any social media, Quora, Twitter, and you can go to readmultiplex.com. It's one of my magazines that I'm running, covering all kinds of things in technology, voice commerce, and payments, and blockchain, and so on.
Great. Well, thanks again for joining us this week. And thank you all for joining us on Breaking Banks. Now, you've probably heard it before, but we're a member of Provoke.fm, which is producing great podcasts about finance and tech industries. You can go to Provoke.fm and find FinTech 5, Serial Entrepreneur, Breaking Banks Asia, and other shows that we created as spin-offs from Breaking Banks. But join the discussion, get on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever your social media channel of choice is, and let us know your feedback. What do you want to see on the show next? What did you like about the show? What didn't you like about the show? We'd love to hear from you. We've got over 200 episodes on the in the backlog, in the back catalog, so be sure to check that out when you can, and leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you download Breaking Banks to listen to it as well. Thanks for joining us again on Breaking Banks. Have a great week and great weekend coming up, and we'll have a new show for you next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.